that you prepare for financial storm that may be coming up? Stay tuned for more information.
Podcast number 78, August 7th, 2018.
So, Menina, where else they can find us besides the YouTube?
Apple Podcast, Android, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, Evox, Telegram, Twitch, Spotify also.
So, Menina, what we have today in the podcast number 78?
We have an interview with Andre Polgar. He wrote the book The Age of Anomaly, Spotting Financial Storms in a Sea of Uncertainty.
So,
let's dive into it.
Let's dive into it right now.
Okay. In the economy we live in, most people are not prepared for what might happen in the future, nor have the capability of seeing anomalies. They can prevent them from a very bad thing. What people might need is a little push in being able to use critical thinking. In my opinion, is what the age of anomaly is here for. That is Andrei Polgar's second book. And Andre also has a YouTube channel called 1 Minute Economics. So let's welcome our special guest now. Welcome, Andre, to MediaVox ENT Blockchain Podcast. How are you now?
Hey, thank you so much for having me. And thank you guys for tuning in. Doing great.
Amazing. Wonderful. Okay. What was the thing or specific moment that made you go into economics? And when was that?
Well, I didn't have the easiest life in the world. You know, growing up in Eastern Europe, I never had a ton of offline opportunities at my disposal. So right from an early age, right out of high school, I did my own thing. I started my own businesses and it went well.
Yes.
I got accepted to university. That went well as well. I set money aside because I was never a big spender. Perfect.
Excellent.
Except, as happens frequently, life gets in the way. And in my case, two things happened. One, my mom got sick and we don't have an amazing medical system here in Romania. So I took her to get proper medical treatment abroad. And two, all of this happened precisely when the global financial crisis of 07 to 08 started. So it was a bit of a perfect storm type situation in that the medical expense in question essentially made me lose all my money, as frequently happens with such expenses, especially once they had to take her to another country. And two, not only that, but my businesses took a major hit after the Great Recession started. So I didn't even exactly drop out of college because I didn't go initially. I focused on my businesses, and only when my businesses started doing well,
yes,
did I eventually go after my my bachelor's, my master's, my PhD. Excellent. So I've always approached economics as a labor of love, as something I did when I was already financially secure.
Yes.
Even now I have so many projects in place that are better at, let's say, putting food on the table than writing books or doing YouTube videos. So essentially, it's all a big balance in my life between, one, my various projects that are pretty good at making money, and two, things that are bigger than myself, my books, my YouTube channel, things I work on because I want to, because they kind of give my life a bigger meaning. And this continuous challenge between finding, which revolves around finding the right balance between these two is essentially, why we're here today, pretty much.
Okay, I see. Now, what inspired you to write The Age of Anomalies?
Well, my personal situation contributed to that as well, because behind the numbers, behind statistics, behind all that, there are people. And the number one thing I'd say to everyone about the crisis is that it's not just something abstract you're going to see on the news. It's going to affect your family members. It's going to affect your friends. And these are extremely serious things. So there was my personal experience. This was coupled with, too, the fact that I have so many people on my 1 Minute Economics YouTube channel who kind of consider me the economist guy on YouTube. And there's a huge responsibility that comes with that, because these people care what I have to say. These people listen to what I have to say.
Correct.
So for these reasons, I didn't want to feel guilty for having major concerns about the economy, but keeping them to myself. So I essentially did the exact opposite. I ended up writing The Age of Anomaly, a pretty huge book, because I know it's probably going to be the only book of its kind that my audience is ever going to read. And I did my best to write it in a from A to Z way, in that I essentially in this book do everything I can to tell people why I'm concerned, to tell people, you know, why I think the things that are happening are going to happen, and unfortunately, that there's nothing they can do to stop it. But at the same time, to identify a silver lining and focus so much energy on making it clear to them that, yes, you cannot stop these things from happening, but you can choose how you position yourself, how you position your family. So while it's impossible to stop these things from occurring, you will be able to land on your feet if you're willing to put in a little bit of work. And most importantly, and this is why I'm here today when nobody's panicking, most importantly, if you're willing to do these things sooner rather than later.
Yes, correct. That's the best idea. Now, human nature seems to be to ignore anomalies because it makes us feel more comfortable, as you said, right? And you show that this happens throughout history. Now, you talk about the importance of having the capability of changing people's mindset in order to help them see reality and build a better future, correct?
Yeah.
Something like that somehow. So when do you get to a point into realizing that many people live in this world where they do not see anomalies and they pretend that they are not there?
The number one mistake I think people who are involved in education make is that they tend to criticize their audience, you know, because you're correct. You know, they say about the average person, hey, look at how people are willing to spend 10 hours binge watching stuff on Netflix, but they're not willing to spend half an hour educating themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a mistake because it has no utility. It's not effective. And what I do is try to help other people in the education space realize that it's our job to reach those people because, the average person is distracted by Netflix, by day-to-day activities, by, you know, we all have families, we all have jobs, occupations, businesses, we all have lives, essentially. And it's always a challenge to get people to pay attention. But if you want to do education properly like I do, you have to think outside the box. Like when it comes to this book, for example, I have been on approximately 100 collaborations all over the world. And, you know, essentially all of these are going to contribute to me reaching as many people as possible. Two, I'm essentially giving the book away by lowering the price to just 99 cents, essentially giving it away, but telling people, you know, symbolically speaking, you're invested with these 99 cents to have some skin in the game. Not only that, I went through the trouble of contacting, you know, quite a few sponsors to set up a contest around my book launch, give people prizes for spreading the word, including a top prize of one Bitcoin.
So yes, I read that today.
All of these things combined are essentially my way of thinking outside the box. Because if people, I've been involved in many industries. I'm also an entrepreneur. I also invest. And based on my experience, I can say firsthand that when selling ideas, you're still selling. And if people don't find out you exist, if people don't find out your book exists, then it's all in vain. And that's kind of been why I'm focusing so much time on spreading the word in, you know, original ways, because it works. Because if I don't reach people, then why have I written the book in the first place? The same way, I did my best to write the book in a way that convinces people to actually finish it, unlike many economists.
I think it was very clear and very easy reading. And I think throughout the process is how you get people into reading the book and getting more educated, because otherwise they would probably wouldn't pay attention. They wouldn't go and look for that book or for that information. So by throughout the process, I hope they can get to it. So.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest pet peeves with economists, with many of my peers, is that we love to sound smart. We love to hear ourselves speak. And the problem is, it drives our audience away a lot of times because people don't want to read a pretentious book where you're just showing off and telling them how many economic terms you know.
Yes.
People want to read a book kind of, they want to have a feeling that there's this friend talking to them. Mm-hmm. They want to have the feeling that the economist who's giving them tips actually understands them. And if you as an economist, if you as a writer, don't manage to kind of hook in, you know, become attached to that person's mind, tap into that mind, and essentially write your book in a way that gets the person in question to actually finish it, then once again, it's all in vain.
Absolutely, yes. I think that's kind of what happened at college. I'm a finance major. Most of my professors, that's how you speak, with all weird terms, especially to me, that English is my second language. And every time I approach them, trying to tell them, can you please say that in plain English, they basically send me to a dictionary. So that's what I had to do. That's how it is. So do you have a favorite crypto project?
Sorry?
Do you have a favorite crypto project? A favorite cryptocurrency coin?
Well, I am pretty involved, especially for an economist. I am pretty involved in the crypto space. Now, of course, at this point, and I don't necessarily, how should I put it, fall in love with one project or another. So at this point, I just happen to be at the risk of sounding like a maximalist, and I'm not necessarily a maximalist, but at this point, based on the market dominance trends I'm seeing, I focus primarily on Bitcoin because that's just what the market dictates, what I believe my strategy should revolve around. But should that change, of course, I'm always open to exploring new projects that, you know, have a decent dev team behind them, projects that have staying power because the technology is actually good. Like, I'm a flexible guy. I've even done arbitrage in South Korea when there was this huge 30% premium on their exchanges. And I'm glad you mentioned this, because speaking of crypto in the context of the next financial crash, I do want to tell people that the things that worked in 2017 to early 2018 will probably not work that great. Or in other words, a lot of people have gotten away with making money by simply investing in random pump and dump coins.
Correct.
And I believe that moving forward, you're going to have to become a lot better at doing your research. You're going to have to become better at actually performing due diligence, seeing which projects are worth it, seeing which projects are not. Because the next financial crisis may very well bring about a big divergence, how I like to call it, in crypto. Or in other words, you are going to have the best of the best in terms of cryptocurrencies that are going to perform remarkably well and act as an excellent hedge against uncertainty.
Yeah.
But your average pump and dump altcoin, probably not so much. You know, like the average person, if he sees that banks are at risk of closing down, for example, or that people are losing confidence in the monetary system, the average person might say, okay, it's time to maybe have a bit of exposure to Bitcoin, or to a strong altcoin, the project that deserves to be here, that has decent technology and so on. Will the same person say, let me just spend all my money on DentaCoin? Probably not. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, an important thing for people to pay attention to. I don't think you're going to get away with making a ton of money without doing proper research. So in August of 2018, as we're speaking right now and beyond, I think it's a good time to start becoming more serious about your process of choosing a cryptocurrency.
Yes. Okay. And diversify a bit more, probably. And don't put everything in cryptos.
So, of course.
Yeah. What was the hardest part of this book? The hardest part to write?
The hardest part is always finding the right balance between having proper research, exposing people to this research. Like, for example, I have chapter 3 with my case studies of economic history. I have a ton of information there, and it was extremely important to give people access to that information. But at the same time, if you want people to finish the book, you have to write each paragraph with the intention in the back of your mind to convince the person who's reading it to continue reading the book and to read the next paragraph as well. So the hardest thing about writing a book is exactly finding this right balance between giving people facts, giving people meaningful information, but also writing the book in an engaging way, in a way that makes people actually finish it.
Yeah, I understand it. Okay, so what is your favorite part of the book? The favorite part?
It would have to be, once again, the part about economic history. And I tell people, we don't study it because it gives us access to a working crystal ball. So history might not repeat itself 100%, but it does rhyme. Like, I have case studies involving anything from the first asset bubble, the first recorded asset bubble, the tulip mania, to recent ones that nobody heard of, like the short domain mania of 2015 to 2016.
I didn't hear about that one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you had these short domains that went from being worth $8 in 2009 to 2010 to being worth over $2,000 each in early 2016, okay, late 2015. And I love it how you have the tulip mania, which peaked in 1636 to 1637. Yeah. Then you have the short domain mania of 2015 to 2016, completely different things, multiple hundreds of years away from one another. Yeah. And yet people are guilty of essentially the same mistakes.
Yeah.
Like in the tulip mania, you had people who were tradesmen, who were weavers, for example, and who used their expensive equipment, their looms, to get loans so that they could speculate on tulip bulbs. The same way in the short domain mania, I had brokers from China, because most of the interest in these domain names was from China. I had Chinese brokers talking to me and saying how great it was that people were getting high interest rate loans over in China to speculate on these domains. So you see, so many hundreds of years away, so different in their nature, and yet the same mistakes do tend to be made. And it's fascinating, and I did my best to go through so many different case studies, which involve anything from tulips to stocks to real estate to precious metals to exotic assets like domains, you name it, because it was my intention of showing people that by studying economic history, we learn a thing or two about human nature. We learn a thing or two about us, essentially. And that's why I'd say this is my favorite dimension of the book.
Yes, human behavior, I think, is fascinating. Is there something you edited out the book, something you took out this book, and if so, why?
I have to say my editors hate me because this is a huge book. But once again, as I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, in the back of my mind, I know that when it comes to my audience, it's going to be the only book of its kind that most people read. So I did my best, and I promised people that now the book is at 400 plus pages, but this is after I've edited out a ton of material. I did my best to only include things in the book that I know deserve to be in the book. But so did I edit a ton of stuff? Yeah. If I were to think about, you know, how big the book would be if I included all of my notes, all of my, you know, all of my ways of interpreting my research, all of the stuff I've eliminated from it on one occasion or another, it would be downright huge. And it does give me goosebumps to think how much work goes actually into a book. Like I could probably fill this room with just books that I've read that have contributed to, in one way or another, me writing this book. So essentially, it's always a Herculean task to write this book because you invest so much. You take from all areas of your life, all the books you've read, all the things you've done, your experience, all that, and you kind of package it into just one book. It's truly awesome.
Yeah. So what is the outcome you expect from people after reading the book?
As someone who is also an entrepreneur, as someone who is trading many markets, I have noticed an important thing, that over half the battle in life is just showing up. It's just doing the work. So essentially, a lot of my book is to a very large degree geared towards getting people to do something practical. I tell them, look, you have this privilege of preparing today when nobody around you is panicking. So the important thing is, for example, for people not to just listen to this conversation and then move on with their lives as if nothing happened. No, the important thing is for people to take this conversation, or if they read my book, to take my book, to internalize the principles I write about it in my book, to kind of make all of those things second nature. But it's not enough to come up with a plan, which I help people do. I stress on the importance of actually executing, doing the work, getting your hands dirty. You don't have, like, this book has been written by the 1 minute economics guy. So if there's anyone on this planet who kind of understands how important people's time is, it's the guy who teaches them economics in 1 minute. So I always tell readers that it's not my intention of getting them to spend 10 hours each day studying economics just so they can become better at economics. No. I'm pretty good at giving them information in just the right dose, and information that's actionable enough for them to be able to actually execute, because that's the key. The average person is complacent. The average person doesn't care. The average person, even at these low interest rates, prefers to keep money at the bank anyway. So it's a world of a difference, as I've mentioned earlier, to just show up, to just put in the work, to just try to establish positions in across different assets. And if you, especially at this stage in the game, it was very important for me to start contacting people with these ideas as early on as possible. Because, of course, if you wait too much, then you can have the smartest economist in the world by your side and he won't do much for you. Yeah. But right now, in this context, you can just achieve so, so much with so, so little investment on your part if you just show some willingness to put in the work.
Yeah, I see. I wanted to mention, on page 110, the last paragraph, it says something like that. There is a world of difference between thinking you can afford a house and being able to truly afford it. What I wanted to say is there's people making that mistake and not understanding the difference today, getting deeper into that, still believing that is what it has to be done. They have to buy a house without being able to see the anomalies. When they can barely pay 3% down payment, having to get a 30-year mortgage, and sometimes even getting a consignor. So basically, I think that's the example that I'm using based in all the examples that you use that we can see here every day.
Yeah, whether it comes to real estate or to other things, there's always a huge discrepancy when it comes to what people think they can quote-unquote afford. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because if you are serious about becoming financially stable, then an important change has to take place up here in your mind, because affording is not the same thing as just because you can afford to get a mortgage or just because you can afford a big screen TV doesn't mean you should get it. And that's the main mistake I feel consumers make. We have become pretty spoiled and entitled. You know, it's so amazing how the average consumer, hey, if you want a big screen TV, perfect. You can afford it, no problem. You can buy it on credit. And especially in developed countries, people have gotten so dependent on this system that revolves around debt because they're used to the instant gratification. Yes. They want things now, and they're not willing to understand that, of course, you need a place to live, but you can get a smaller one, which is just as good. You don't have to get a huge house so that you can make your friends envious of how successful mm-hmm. you are. You don't have to spend all your money keeping up with the Joneses, like people say in the United States. But many people do. The problem is, you might feel good initially, but once you sign the dotted line, you're going to have to pay back that loan with interest. Once you get essentially a big screen TV on loan, once again, you're going to have to pay it back with even bigger interest percentage-wise. Yes. So this is something the average consumer needs to pay attention to. There's a reason why people right now, I remember studies like the one in 2015 by Bankrate, which mm-hmm. shows that the average American, so people from the richest country in the world, the average American would not be able to properly withstand an unexpected expense such as $500. And it's crazy for people in the strongest country in the world, in these times of relative prosperity, for the average person to still be essentially living paycheck to paycheck and just getting by. And one of the main reasons why I've written this book and why I'm trying so hard to reach as many people as possible is precisely that. Yes. It gives me goosebumps to think about just how fragile the average consumer is now.
Correct, yes.
Let's not even talk about what position the average person would be in if a major economic reset were to happen.
Yes, it would be like in a very bad situation. Yes, actually, we know people who got a house that is over 450K, but at the same time, if they had to fix a car and they had to pay 200, 300, 400, they do not have the money to do so. At the same time, they are like showing off, hey, look at my house and all those things. I think that's how people they are being raised in the US and somehow consumism all the way. And they don't think about the future in the long term.
Of course. One of the main things I try to always teach readers is that eventually, even if you can sometimes postpone this moment a lot, eventually there is a price to pay. Do you want to feel good for bragging to your neighbors about how successful you are? Perfect. The market is going to figure out a way to let you do it. It lets you buy a home you cannot afford on credit. It lets you buy furniture for it also on credit. It lets you essentially do all of these things, which give you the impression that you're wealthy, things that give other people the impression that you're wealthy. But this charade cannot go on forever because it is a charade. It's all a mirage. You're buying it on credit. You're essentially living above your means. And it is true. One of the main things that people say in the investment world is that the market can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent. So things can remain irrational for an extended period of time. But I would add, they cannot do so forever. And eventually, the same principle is valid when it comes to the idea of preparing for an economic crisis. Sure, we can, you know, our economy can be on an unsustainable path for a longer time than people realize, but it cannot do that forever. And eventually, there's a price to be paid. And when that moment comes, the average person, because it is the average person that I'm especially worried for, the average person is going to get decimated, I think.
Yes, yes. Okay, is there something else you might want to add?
Well, my main goal with these many collaborations I'm on is essentially simple. I do give the book away and, you know, organize a contest, do my best to kind of make people understand that my book launch is not a funeral. So an important mindset related thing that I want to share with people before we end this is that I'm an optimistic guy. You know, I have a contest for my book. I have these many prizes. You know, you can check out my videos. They always have a positive feel to them. So I'm an optimist in life, and you should be too. But when making plans, it's smart to err on the side of pessimism. So be pessimistic when making plans, but optimistic in life. This is an important mindset related issue. And kind of like as a final message, if people buy The Age of Anomaly, you know, perfect. I hope they manage to put my information to good use. If they subscribe to my YouTube channel, I am happy to have them. But even if they don't, even if their solution in no way includes me, the only thing I ask of people, of those who are listening to us right now, is that they don't just move on with their life after watching this, after tuning into this discussion. Mm-hmm. I would consider it the biggest victory in the world if those who are listening right now would do something meaningful after this conversation is over. What that something is entirely up to them. Whether it's just taking a 1 hour walk to think about their financial future or how well positioned or not they are in the context of the next financial crash, whether it's something completely different, as long as people do at least something that has to do with preparedness after this conversation, I will be a very happy camper.
Hey, that's wonderful. Okay, so we are going to put the link to buy The Age of Anomaly below our video. And it has been our pleasure to have you here with us, Andre. We wish to see you again soon at MediaBoard ENT Blockchain.
Thank you so much. I genuinely hope people manage to extract a ton of value from our conversation today. And yeah, be careful out there, guys.
Yeah, you have another book coming up, by the way. Do you have another plan?
Right now, my plans revolve around, you know, kind of getting my life back a bit after this insane period with you know.
I imagine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. But then again, I love writing so much that I'm 100% convinced that after 24 hours of me taking time off, I'm going to want to get back to work. So the answer is yes. I'm probably going to start working on my next book a lot sooner than I realize at this point.
Okay. Okay. So we wish you all the super best, and we'll see you next time.
Perfect. Take care.
Bye.